I would tell you at the time that I was fine to be stripping, that there was nothing inherently wrong with being naked, and there's nothing inherently wrong with dancing. And therefore, what I'm doing is not perverted unless the observer makes it perverted, and that's on them, not on me. And like, I had all these kind of like, and I'm making money, and I'm finally taking back control of what had been taken from me, and I have the upper hand, and all these stories I was telling myself about the experience of working in strip clubs, that were just really false and a part of kind of like helping me survive it. But in retrospect, I can definitely see that it was re-victimization, re-exploitation, and almost a reenacting of all of my earlier trauma.
Hello and welcome to The Naked Gospel, where we have conversations about sex, singleness, marriage, pornography, and everything in between. We bring on cultural thinkers, parents, important folk, and normal folk alike. I am your host, Shane O'Neill. If you're listening in, video versions of all of these episodes are available at YouTube, Proven Ministries. We have that below. If you're watching, you just rather listen in, then all of these episodes are available on every major podcast platform. Whether you're listening or watching, do subscribe and continue to track with us. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy the episode. Hey guys, thanks for joining us today. Today we're looking at the supply and demand of pornography and sex trafficking. So the supply obviously being pornography and prostitution. But when it comes to the demand, the demand is us, the viewers, the consumers. And it's just so easy to judge people who are pornographers or in prostitution. But we don't often evaluate our own role in that cycle. And I just want to take, just this time to look at it, to evaluate it. We've asked Harmony Dust to join us. She has shared her story on here before. She was on here a few months back. If you're interested in that episode, we'll have it down below. She used to be a stripper. She was exploited in the industry, and Jesus saved her, as he does. And she's coming back on to process with us what the industry is like and that relationship between supply and demand. She's also started a organization called Treasures. You can check it out at iamatreasure.com, and where she helps women who are trying to get out of the industry get their lives back, rebuild community, reforge relationships, get their feet back underneath them. It is a really cool organization. I encourage you guys to check it out just so that you're aware of it. I don't know of very many like it. She's done such a good job. And if there are any ladies who are listening who are looking to kind of break away from, issues of lust or pornography, we are running a discount with Proven Ministries. If you're interested in resources there, you can use the promo code WOMENSTRUGGLE2. T-O-O, and we'll have that down below as well. You can check out the website, check out the resources. Again, it's 30% off. So thank you for being with us. Thank you for joining us. And as always, if this episode encourages you or you think it's beneficial, please share with somebody you think would benefit from it. Let's jump into the interview. Harmony, thank you for being here today. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a human living on planet Earth in 2021. So good days, bad days, but all is well.
Yeah. Where are you located? So even before we jump into the organization that you and your team have built, where is it located? Where are you located?
Los Angeles, California is where we are. San Fernando Valley, if you're familiar with the landscape of LA. But we've trained people all over the world on 6 continents in like 120 cities. So we have little plantings all over.
Yeah. Little outposts. It's a need that is unfortunately multicultural, multi-continental.
100%. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I came across Treasures maybe a year ago or so, and was just blown away by your website and by what you guys do. And so just to give the people listening context. Obviously, you've been on before. You've shared your story with us. I want to look particularly at what you guys are doing because I'm so blind to this side of reality. And it deeply impacts a lot of lives. And I don't want to be blind to that. I just don't. Yeah. And knowing other people and seeing the people behind the pleasure, it helps to reshape my soul. And I need that. I really need that. That's why I asked you on last time just to share your story because it did good things inside of me. So how did you even get kind of a vision for this and kind of the inception of it? How did this start?
Yeah. I mean, so as we talked about on your previous podcast, I'm a survivor of a lot of things, including abuse and exploitation in the sex industry and strip clubs. And, you know, after a long and interesting process with God of, you know, really rediscovering my true authentic identity and developing a relationship with Him and beginning the journey of really walking with Him, I just had this thing in my heart that I knew that everything I went through was not going to be in vain and that it was going to be somehow used for good. Like even as I was living out like those defining moments where it's like you're at a crossroads and you have to make a choice, I had this sense that I was going to have to be accountable for the choices I made along the way. And I was going to have to share them with other people, like as a roadmap. So, that was really important to me, even as I was in the thick of the beginning of my recovery journey. But eventually I found myself sitting across the street from the club where I used to work, praying for the women and realized like, okay, it's great to pray, but I have to do something. Mm. You know, there are women still working there. People I know, my own coworkers that I had previously worked with that might be feeling as trapped and alone as I once did. And that I wanted to do something, to reach them. And so it all started with me writing notes on the back of postcards I had in my car, a postcard, and it said her value is far above rubies and pearls. And I just wrote notes on the back of those cards because I thought that is exactly the message that I want to take to the women, to remind them that they are valuable, that they have intrinsic worth, that's not dependent on, you know, who wants to pay for them that night or pay for their time. So that's how it started. I was really, I don't know. I was a reluctant leader. Like I took the idea to pastor at my church to start something up, strip club outreach. I had never heard of it. This is 18 years ago. So this kind of thing wasn't happening. Exploitation trafficking wasn't talked about. There was no roadmap. And I took the idea to a pastor at church and he was like, this is great. You should definitely start it. I'm like, maybe one day when I finish grad school, cause I just started grad school. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, you got to start it now. And he actually essentially lovingly pushed me into it by recruiting volunteers on my behalf without me knowing. And here we are today.
Hmm. I love that. What are the kind of mission or vision? What is the vision of Treasures?
Yeah, to reach and equip women in the commercial sex industry and those that have experienced exploitation and trafficking to live healthy, flourishing lives. And we do that through three main areas of focus through our outreach program. So we do outreach to strip clubs, women in porn through HIV testing centers, women and girls in online forums that are being exploited. And then we work in juvenile detention centers and sometimes work with youth through Department of Probations and some other partnerships. So those are kind of the outreach pieces. We're most known for strip club outreach, but we do outreach in a lot of different areas. And then care, which includes support groups, one-on-one mentoring, and just really walking alongside women in their recovery process and helping them get connected to resources both within Treasures and outside of Treasures that they need to thrive. And then the third area of focus is training people in, first of all, training and educating the public in general on the issues of trafficking and exploitation, on the nuances, on, you know, just helping really people see behind the curtain. And then we have a digital training program that's designed specifically to train and equip people in best practices for outreach and care. And we used to do that in person, but now we have them digital. So it's really awesome to see God using that to just equip people around the world to do some really awesome work. So it's been quite a ride.
Yeah, I believe it. So there's this image, this cultural image of like pornography and you know, strip clubs, that it's free expression, and that it's more to the point, freedom. It's a freedom of mm-hmm. expressing who someone is, a liberation of the body. And so a lot of people do view these kinds of categories that we're talking about in almost positive, idealistic ways. And so I'd be interested just to know, what is the connection between pornography and these other settings and sex trafficking or sexual exploitation?
Yeah. Yeah. So there definitely are those kind of myths out there that the sex industry is empowering. And truthfully, it does offer a false sense of empowerment to women, especially, and especially women who have experienced childhood abuse and, you know, sexual assault and sexual violence. A very high percent, up to 90%, have that history of childhood sexual abuse in their background. And that's not a coincidence. Mm-hmm. Those moments where we find ourselves sexually abused are moments of like extreme powerlessness over our own body, right? Like, yeah. Like as children, as without a voice, without the ability to say no, without the power. And then the sex industry offers this opportunity, air quotes, to take back control of your sexuality, to use it to your advantage, to exploit yourself, to you know, profit off of your own exploitation. And so that is if you're not like me and giving all of your money to a pimp, as I was. So that is part of the lure. But for me, I know it didn't take long for me to realize that the person in the equation with the power was the one with the money and not me, because they called the shots, because that's what the demand does. And that your job is to cater to the wants, needs, and desires of the demand, really at the expense of yourself. But as human nature goes, you know, when you're in a situation, you have to find a way to survive it. So some of those defense mechanisms definitely were at play for me: denial, rationalization. And so I would tell you at the time that I was fine to be stripping, that there was nothing inherently wrong with being naked, and there's nothing inherently wrong with dancing. And therefore what I'm doing is not perverted, unless the observer makes it perverted, and that's on them, not on me. And like, I had all these kind of like, and I'm making money, and I'm finally taking back control of what had been taken from me, and I have the upper hand, and all these stories I was telling myself about the work, if you can't call it that, about the experience of working in strip clubs, that were just really false and a part of kind of like helping me survive it. But in retrospect, I can definitely see that it was re-victimization, re-exploitation, and almost a reenacting of all of my earlier trauma. Mm. Yeah. And if the sex industry were empowering to people, we wouldn't see the rates of PTSD that we do. We see rates of PTSD among women in the sex industry that are equivalent to combat war veterans. Mm. If the commercial sex industry was truly empowering, we wouldn't see that. We wouldn't see the levels of depression. We wouldn't see the high rates of homelessness, even among people in like corn, in places in the industry where you'd think it's actually lucrative and people should be making money. You still see high rates of poverty and homelessness. We wouldn't see that if the industry were truly empowering. The level of substance abuse and addictions, and just the vulnerability of the people who end up there. If it were empowering, the wealthy elite would be sending their children to porn sets and strip clubs, but they're not, right? If it were truly empowering, we'd see that, but we don't. We see the marginalized, the disenfranchised, the vulnerable people in our society that are already struggling with vulnerability. Hmm.
I remember the first time, it was several years ago, maybe 10 years ago, where I first came across that term of sex worker, in direct contrast to the lingo of prostitution, prostitute. Mm-hmm. And so even trying to rebrand the activity to dignify it, to show, you know, like a sex worker, like, no, I'm a worker and I just work in this field. And now that's pretty much ubiquitous. Kind of everywhere I look, it's talking about sex working or even more mundane terms. Because you talk through referencing some statistics, and I saw from your website, I cheated a little bit, but that 90% mm-hmm. of women in the sex industry come from abuse, childhood abuse. What are some other stats that you've collected and seen over the last few years?
Yeah, I mean, 70% of trafficking, domestic minor trafficking victims in the U.S. are from the foster care system. High rates of trafficking among runaways, throwaways, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, super high rates, especially when it comes to trafficking. I can't remember off the top of my head, but we do have a free downloadable stat guide with the list of works cited and accurate numbers, but I'm pretty sure it's 69% of domestic minor trafficking victims I know at least LA are African American.
Oh.
But they represent a much smaller percentage of the population, but a very high percentage of those being victimized in trafficking.
The ratio. Yeah.
And then you talked about, you know, the language. It is important because it does shape mindsets and it perpetuates ideology that informs then practices and policy and laws and all. It's like affects all the layers. And in fact, the idea of sex work, this idea that sex work is work, is really one of the foundations of the movement to fully decriminalize prostitution. And it's that idea that it's just work. It's a job like any other. And it's this is the belief that it's the stigma that makes it so terrible and dangerous, not the work itself, right? But when you look at all the places where prostitution has been legalized or fully decriminalized, we see increased trafficking. We don't see decrease in violence against prostituted people. And so language matters. So for us, you know, we're taught, the language we use is like people in prostitution, because they are not prostitutes, because that's nobody's identity, right? People in prostitution, prostituted people, people who are being exploited or trafficked, right? So I'm very careful to use any kind of label, stripper, porn star, whatever. It's because I was never a stripper. That was never who I was. That was something I did for a time in my life, but that was never my identity. So I think language is important, even in that like kind of small minutia.
It's very important because that's who you weren't, right? Like that,
exactly.
That's the person you weren't supposed to be. And then to just assume that like, that's who I, even to say that's who I was implies that that's an identity that you once wore, which might be true to us in a sense, but nonetheless, it's a misshaped story. So I really like how intentional you are with language. I want to ask kind of an indelicate question. You talk about your mission and your vision and being located in several locations. The kind of the question that comes to mind is it working? Is what you're doing bearing fruit? Is it successful? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, so first of all, the 120 locations, those are autonomous groups of people that have been trained by Treasures, but are operating completely autonomously.
That's awesome.
To answer your question, yes, I'm constantly hearing stories from them about people's lives being changed. But here with the work that we do at Treasures, and we are now that it's been kind of a blessing in disguise in terms of like being forced to figure out a way to create virtual support groups, because now we have support groups that we're able to offer to women outside of the city and outside of the state. So we have women logging into our virtual support groups literally from all over the world, and it's beautiful. I keep in my inbox a folder called encouragement and thank yous, because every single time I receive a message, text, phone call, anything from a woman who's like, hey, here's how Treasures has impacted my life. Here's what my life looks like today. Here's what that seed you sowed, you know, here's the fruit that it yielded. I keep those on hand because I need to remember those when the work gets hard, and it does get hard. But there's not a week that goes by that I don't hear from someone that's been impacted by the grace of God, by the work that Treasures has been able to do for the past 18 years.
I love that. I love that so much. Oh, God bless you. I want to go back to that name. Kind of, it's kind of a parenthetical point that you made, but it's so strong. So instead of, okay, so I was talking to somebody just yesterday about how there's this false idea, I think it's a false idea in Christianity, that kind of only associating yourself as a sinner can really just pile on this identity of guilt and shame. And there's a sense in which, absolutely, like, I am a sinner saved by grace. And like Paul said, I'm the chief of sinners. Like, I genuinely believe that in my heart. But the stuff that humbles my heart the most is when I go for a walk and pray out loud, God, thank you for naming me holy. Thank you for naming me blameless and above reproach. When I start to, like, chosen, like, dearly beloved son, when I start putting those names on, they humble my heart in a way that nothing else can, because I know they're so experientially untrue, but it's how heaven sees me, right? And I didn't earn any of that. He just really likes me and loves me, and that humbles me day after day. And that's where sanctification bears the most fruit in my life. So when there's a good, just like this beautiful contrast that you've created of like stripper or pornographer, and then all of a sudden treasure. How did you pick the name Treasures and the website that went along with it, I Am a Treasure? There's a very intentional identity piece that you're trying to give, and maybe a culture of kind of heavenly naming that you're trying to impart. Would you mind talking a bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. So I would love to take credit for it. But remember I told you about that pastor who was recruiting volunteers for me? Truthfully, he was like, if I were not a man, I would start this. And he kind of did, because it was something that was in my heart to do and that I had vision for, but I was very afraid and like, what would it look like? And I don't know. And I'm not a leader. I'm just a girl who just walked out of my own mess, you know? Yeah. And so he said, I think I even have a great name for it. I think it would be cool to call it Treasures Out of Darkness, based on the scripture that says, I will go before you. I will break the bars of iron and I will give you treasures out of dark places or out of darkness. And yes. I was like, sounds good. Cool, Jeff. Like, love it. And so that's where it came from. But this is actually, we talk about this in our trainings, like the importance of a name, and that it's important that it reflects who you are and what you want to accomplish in a way that the people you're reaching can hear. And so when we first showed up at the strip clubs with our little, you know, cards or whatever, and it said Treasures Out of Darkness on it, apparently they hadn't read Isaiah and they were like, out of darkness. And I was like, oh, interesting. It's not landing on your ears the way it's landed on mine. And so we just changed it to treasures, because that's essentially what we're saying, is you're a treasure. And sometimes, like, the, you know, the truth of who we are and all that God has created us to be and the purpose that he's called us to walk in, it's in us all along. And sometimes it just needs to be excavated and pulled out. And sometimes there are bars that need to be broken down and pathways that need to be made and freedom that needs to be, you know, given and laid hold of, but that's in us all along. So, you know, God doesn't love me any more right now in this moment than he did when I was in the deepest of messes working in the strip club under the control of a pimp in the middle of a table dance. Like, he loved me exactly as much then as he does now. And the truth of my identity and who he created me to be was in me all along. And he saw through all of my circumstances to that. And he loved me and believed in me all along. And so that's really what we want to say to the women, is like, it's in you and you are loved. You are valuable and you are created with a purpose. That's our tagline, love, value, purpose. It's like, that's, and we want women to have to type in when they go to our website, we named our website, iamatreasure.com, because we wanted the women to have to type, I am a treasure, when they were looking us up, because we wanted them to just reaffirm the truth of their actual identity.
That's some beautiful thoughtfulness, because it makes them own it even as they're wondering what it is, which is really cool. Hi, Harmony, I love that. I'm kind of curious. This is kind of more a point of curiosity than anything else. When it comes to, so you've communicated that there is a pretty big connection between kind of the private entertainment that we think of it as with pornography and being trafficked, being exploited. But then a lot of, amongst my peers, I even dated someone who did this. So it's called camming. It's when you kind of record yourself, either kind of like stripping or in some kind of sexual act. And it's really popular. Even the girl I dated would, you know, just do it because people can send in money and they ask you to do things. And she'd do it to, like, you know, buy pizza that night. And and it was very casual. And it seems like there's almost more a fixation on doing camming than there is in even viewing camming, that people who do camming almost get like addicted to the practice of doing it, which is very curious. Couples will do it, college students, whatever, where they're just live feeding their just kind of sexual endeavor. So I've read a lot of articles where people are lauding that. They're applauding camming because it's taking empowerment in your own hands. There's no pimp involved. There's no industry. You're just doing it on your own terms. Could you speak to that for a second? Because it sounds like somebody would argue that, yeah, what you're fighting against is the industry, but this allows us to do it on our own terms.
Right. Okay, so there's a lot of can of worms there. So first of all, because I don't know that we've done this yet in this interview, I do want to just strengthen the connection we're drawing between the commercial sex industry at large and trafficking. Because I think we've alluded to it, but I don't think we've like helped people really who don't know get there. So 70% of female trafficking victims are trafficked into the commercial sex industry, including legal forms of it. So sometimes we think of trafficking as this out there kind of nebulous or underground thing that, you know, you don't really know. It's happening right in front of us. It happens in strip clubs, on porn sets, in escorting, prostitution, camming, in every single area, massage parlors, in every single area where the commercial sex industry exists, trafficking is happening. The reason is that there it's a supply and demand issue. When there are not enough people to willingly sell themselves or engage in commercial sexual services, supply has to be created by any means necessary in order to meet the demand. And therefore, traffickers and pimps and exploiters have incentive to then lure, trick, coerce, you know, women and men and boys into the commercial sex industry in order to meet that demand that exists. So that's the first thing.
Yeah.
And I could go on and on about that, but just to kind of like simply draw that connection. Then when you're talking about camming, and in another area that's like kind of similar is the OnlyFans space that we're seeing that's become very popular, even though there's some shifts that are going to be happening soon to the policies there around pornography. But this idea of camming, so yes, some of the arguments for camming and what we saw when the pandemic began is a lot of people who previously worked in, you know, strip clubs and legal entities where commercial sexual services were being provided, they did find themselves wondering, okay, how do I make ends meet, and turn to camming and OnlyFans and this sort of thing. One of the arguments that's been made for why this is a better avenue is that, you know, it's less dangerous than, let's say, street prostitution or escorting or any kind of like full services where you are face to face with a client. Because what we also know about buyers, according to research, is there's very high levels of violence in prostitution. You know, 70% of women in prostitution have been raped at least five times. Wow. And the, you know, the physical violence, threatened with a weapon, attack. I mean, brutalized. Like, I just, it's almost too much to talk about, just the extreme level of violence and the impact that that has, right? So one of the arguments for these kind of other spaces like camming and OnlyFans is that there's less violence than in street prostitution, which is true. And the other one being, like, let's say for a woman who's working in the porn industry, usually a lot of times what women experience in the porn industry or people experience in the porn industry is they sign up for it. They say, here are my boundaries. I'm willing to do these scenes, but not these scenes. Right. And they get sent on, you know, a job and they're told it's one thing. They show up at set. It's another. They're being pushed and pressured to do beyond their boundaries, threatened. You're never going to work in this town again. If you don't do X, Y, Z, people are going to think you're too difficult to work with. I'm going to ruin your name. I'm going to ruin your career. And then they find themselves doing more than they ever planned to in the first place, with all these other people getting all these cuts of it and making a very small piece of the pie. So with camming and, you know, OnlyFans, one of the arguments for it is that, well, I have more autonomy and I'm keeping a bigger slice of the pie. However, it's still not empowering because at the end of the day, the person with the power is the demand, because they are the ones who are telling you, do this, do that, do this, do that. Here's what I want. Here's what I demand, right? This is the demand, and you have to meet it. And if you don't, the next person will. So you're always going to be at the mercy of the demand. And this same kind of element is happening where people will get into these kind of arenas thinking like, I'm only going to do X, Y, Z, and ABC, and I'm not going to do all these other things. And then they find themselves, you know, with rent to pay or mouths to feed or, whatever, you know, kind of financial pressures that they're experiencing. And they find themselves doing more than they ever wanted to make that money because the demand is demanding it. So it's still not empowering. And at the end of the day, it's turning people into products. And I think there's a real problem with that.
Thank you.
And I think that there's a price for that. There's a cost. Yeah. It costs. I know for myself, like, it costs me my sense of self and my sense of identity.
There's a cost even for the person who watches. There's a,
for sure,
a cost. I mean, even it doesn't take me many kind of logical premises to get to understanding that watching pornography and acting out is self-abuse, that I'm abusing and using myself in ways that I was never intended to. And I'm taking my passion, like my richest passion, and I'm throwing it into a pixelated hole. You know, I'm married now and I don't have that right. And I've talked about this on another podcast, but learning to have sex that's filled with intimacy has freaked me out in all the best ways in marriage, because for 15 years I practiced sex without intimacy.
Right.
On varying occasions, but then all of a sudden to have sex where there's another person looking back at you, you know, all of a sudden it just freaked me out in the first few months of marriage. And it's been really good for me, kind of this relational new conditioning. And I've loved every bit of it, and I've chafed at every bit of it, but it's been really good. I do want to talk on that. So the demand has the power, because it's demanding the action from you, from your friends, from whomever it might be. But the demand is still the one who's being empowered, and you're just a product of that demand. That's what I hear you saying, yeah?
Right. That's for sure what I'm saying. And, you know, another thing about it, so there's a book called Female Chauvinist Pig, and she kind of is talking about the internalized sexism in a hypersexualized culture. And it's a really good book. But one of the points she's making is the fact that basically we're this society of people that's actually modeling our sexuality off of porn. Like, kids are learning about sex from porn. People are learning about what sexuality looks like through porn, especially when they're not provided any healthy alternatives for sex education in places where the church is unwilling to talk about what healthy sexuality and healthy intimacy, sexual intimacy looks like. And so people are learning about sex through porn and modeling sexuality off of porn, using that as a yardstick. I literally had women in the church ask me if I could teach them to strip for their husbands, right? Like now it happens less now that people know I don't play. But when I was like younger and in my 20s and just trying to figure out my life, that was a thing. In fact, I know this is terrible, but this is years ago. There was a quote unquote ministry that their fundraiser was, they had the women teach stripping to the wives in the church. And then the wives paid the ministry donations and basically exploited the women even more. Wow. The most terrible thing I've heard, but why? Because we're modeling our sexuality off of pornified culture. But the point that she makes in her book is that we're modeling our sexuality off of a sexually traumatized group of people, because this is a group of people that has experienced such high rates of childhood sexual abuse, sexual violence, sexual trauma. So we're modeling our sexuality off of a group of people that are sexually traumatized. And how healthy is that?
That's been a big area of, just to personalize it again, a big area of our relational development between Kaylee and I in marriage. Because she'll ask at certain points, did you get that from porn? Like, she'll ask that. And it's always a humbling question because it's like, did I? You know, like, I have to ask myself that question because for so many of us, pornography was our sex ed.
Right.
Which is exactly what you're saying. I do want to I want to spend just the rest of the time talking about the demand aspect of this because we are so quick to make villains of porn stars and prostituting. Sorry, I'm trying to be conscientious of the name of, we're so quick to vilify them. And it's wild because it's something like 97% of men in the church have viewed pornography. And yet 100% of the church will condemn pornographers, like porn stars, because they'll still intentionally see them, label them that way and say kind of, you're the scum of the earth. You're the ones who need Jesus the most. And they don't say that in a very generous sort of way. So we're really quick. It just kind of reminds me of there in the Old Testament where you literally take a lamb, lay your hands on it, symbolizes putting your sin on it and then sending it out into the wilderness to die. It's at one point wanting to use it for food, but then we literally, pardon the graphic language, we spill our sin onto these people and then we send them off. As though we, you know, it's like, oh, shame on them. You know, we condemn them so quickly. And so I guess what is your approach to the demand? Like if you're looking at the demand, you're seeing the demand is having the power. What does it look like for all of us as individuals and as communities to really pay attention and try to subvert the power of that demand?
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting, that perspective. And yes, I do see that experience in the church. And it's this whole like, okay, well, women are responsible for the sexual responses of men is essentially what that is. And it's like, it even goes back to like the little things like, don't wear tank tops. Why? Because you'll cause your brother to stumble and that's the message that ultimately you're responsible for the sexual responses of men. And so there, and it is my responsibility to behave in such a way that can hopefully stave off his sexual attraction to me, but not placing accountability on the man for his own sexual responses. So that's just very deeply ingrained in, I know, at least Western church, right?
And Western culture.
It has heartbreaking to see some women that I love. Huh?
And Western culture across, I mean, that's what kind of rape culture is branded as, the slut walks, where people walk through downtowns wearing whatever they want because they're saying, it's my body. You don't have a right just to have it however you want. They'll be, you know, and they're proving a point, and it's a really rough way to prove it, but they're saying the exact same thing. So it's apparent in the church and outside of the church.
That's true. Very, very true. But in the church, I've certainly seen women that we serve, you know, come in and find that, like, let's say, like, you know, someone who is known in the porn industry, and everyone's afraid that their husbands are gonna like stray just because she's sitting in a pew, you know.
That sucks.
So that's been really hard, right? It's been really hard. But at the end of the day, so many of the women that I know would never have entered into the commercial sex industry if there weren't a demand. So it's the demand that's driving the whole industry. So I do believe that, you know, and if we are ever going to see an end to exploitation trafficking, it's going to require the demand, which is primarily men. It also is women. Just want to say that 1 in 3 visitors to porn websites are women from the data that I've seen, but it's primarily driven by men, and it's always going to exist, and it's always going to be a problem, which means exploitation trafficking will always exist as long as there's demand. But men can be the solution, and the demand can be the solution by saying, I'm not going to participate in this demand anymore. I'm not going to be part of the problem. And that's the only way we're going to be able to make a dent in this. But you know, with that said, like when you talk about what's my perspective of the demand in my heart, it's like no one's winning. Everyone loses, right? No one's really winning here. People who are participating in the demand are settling for a counterfeit version of healthy sexuality and intimacy and, you know, false intimacy and are, you know, shortchanging themselves, but meanwhile participating in this beast that is leading to the exploitation and of vulnerable people. So nobody's winning.
Yeah. We're so quick to criticize the supply. We're saying porn is everywhere. And then we don't take a step back and say, well, it's because most of us are watching it, you know? And like, I don't ever, you know, like I've heard plenty of pastors condemn pornography, but I haven't then heard him take that follow up and say, it's because most of us have a history with pornography.
Right.
You don't have to be in the industry to have a history with pornography.
It's wild to hear you say that, because I've been in anti-trafficking for so long that all I hear and all we talk about is it's a supply and demand issue. The demand is the problem. That's a big part of the problem. Of course, there's all the other societal issues and all these other things, right? But the demand is a huge part of the problem. And it's addressing demand has to be a huge part of the solution. So it's wild, but yes, you're right. That I'm sure in many spaces that's not being talked about, and it needs to be talked about for sure. Mm. And also in a way that's not, you know, overly shaming and condemning either, because what we do know is, you know, sexual addiction is driven by shame. So, but really calling people to a higher standard of seeing people as humans and not as objects and not as products that exist for your pleasure.
That's too tangential. I do want to ask, and this will be the final question before we close. I'd be interested in hearing, let's see, how to frame this. So we're looking at particulars here, but we're also then saying, well, this is also systemic at a cultural level. And so kind of a culture... I've heard the phrase kind of an over-sexualized culture or porn culture, which addresses the systemic realities. But there's no real positive framing on that. I would like to hear what you long for, a culture of fill in the blank. It's not just here, like we are disconnected from one another and disenfranchised. Families are falling apart. And even one of your stats was something like 98% of women want to get out of the industry, but they can't. Again, 90% of women
89.
Have been abused.
Yeah.
89, thank you. 90% have been abused when they were younger. So there's this broader culture of something nefarious and ugly. But the contrast, like what is the contrast that you would love to see?
It's utopia. But I mean, truthfully, okay. So yeah. So this data is 89% of women in the commercial sex industry want to leave, but don't see any other options for survival. So first and foremost, viable options for women to make livable wage outside of selling their bodies. That's a huge problem. We're still dealing with gender pay gaps and, you know, the educational system. Your education is going to depend on what neighborhood you live in, whether or not you have a good one or a not so good education, which then leads to what kind of opportunities you have. The foster care system, 70% of trafficking victims are from the foster care system. What does foster care reform look like? You know, what would it actually look like if, you know, I mean, not just Christian families adopted children and kept them from being vulnerable. But also on top of that, what would it look like if we stopped removing children from families because they couldn't afford a bed? And instead of putting them in a system that's going to lead to further abuse and ultimately possibly them being trafficked into prostitution, what if we just bought that family a bed, right? Like, or what if we helped the family get the resources that they need so they could have some food in their cupboard so the child wouldn't be removed from a loving home in the first place? That's broken, right? Like what if we didn't see women as objects and they were not sexualized? What if that was preposterous to us? What if we saw television and advertising and billboards, and if there was sexualization of women? Because if we see men, if you saw a man bent over on the front of a car, I mean, thankfully we're not seeing as much advertising like this, but you still see it, right? Like, you know, you'd be like, what is happening? Like, this is awful. But you can see women in these hypersexualized advertisements and positions, and we don't even think anything of it because it's so normal to us. But what if we lived in a world where we're like, whoa, that's not cool. It's wild to watch television and media through my daughter's eyes, because she doesn't miss anything. She is like Mrs. Justice. And these kids, I'm telling you, this next generation is going to call us up to a new place, because she does not play. She's like, there's not enough female representation in that cartoon. There's only one female character and there's 10 boy characters. There's no cultural diversity in that book. It's all the main characters are, you know, one type of way or white or whatever. Like, she's calling it out. Like, and she's 13 and she's been calling it out since she was like a little tiny child. So I have a lot of hope that this next generation is going to steer us in the right direction. But truthfully, it is a very complex issue with so many layers of complexity and involvement in so many systems of society that are broken, that there's not just a one fix, like a fix all. And that sounds overwhelming. That sounds like, oh, well, then we can't do anything. Yes, you can. Like, we can all find something that we can do, right? Like, so maybe one person's passion is education and bringing, you know, better education and more equality in education. Maybe another person's passion is foster care reform, or, you know, keeping families together, or there's a million things that can be done. It's just a matter of figuring out what our part is. And maybe our part is as simple as committing to not participate in the demand, and starting there would be a great place to start.
Amen. I'm going to cheat and ask you, real quick, what does it look like for you to practice hope? I ask that question because a lot of people who are stuck watching pornography don't have hope for themselves. And a lot of parents don't have hope for the culture. They don't have hope for their children. And you're in a different context from even those two, although you are a mother, but you're looking at these women who are in the industry and men who are in the industry. What does it look like for you to practice hope? Because I think we can learn something from that.
That's such an interesting question, because I've actually been meditating on hope lately and like really finding myself needing to, you know, John Eldridge?
Yeah.
I love John Eldridge. So he has this app called the 1 Minute Pause, and he has meditations on different areas. And one of them, you can actually meditate on hope. And so like part of the prayer is like, God, heal hope within me, renew hope within me. So I really have actually been having to do that lately, because truthfully, this is hard work. And it's very difficult to see people that I care about struggle and face insurmountable odds and barriers that no matter what we do, we can't remove some of these barriers, right? Like, I can't give every woman that walks through the doors of Treasures a job paying livable wages, yeah. Right? So
yeah,
meditating on hope. And I mean, at the end of the day, truthfully, just really practicing the presence of Jesus, because he's the only hope, right? Like, that's it. That's it. Where would I be without him? And yeah.
Well, Harmony, you're awesome. I enjoy having you on. Thank you for sharing yourself, your story, your experiences with us so freely. It's rich stories, but you're also very bright. Just tracking with your thoughts, I'm like, wow, that's smart. That's very insightful, and really grateful for your presence. We always end with two questions. One, how can people track with you? What kind of resources you have out there? And two, how can people be praying for you?
Yeah, for sure. So iamatreasure.com is the website. I'm on social media at Harmony Grillo, so connecting with us in either of those places. And we're in the process of raising money for our recovery home, our freedom home, where we want to be able to run our programs and host dinners and just provide a safe place for women to heal. So if that resonates with anyone listening, would love to invite you to be a part of that. One of the things that I do love is so many of the people that support Treasures financially used to participate in the demand and are redirecting the money that they used to use towards the demand to helping women recover. And that's beautiful. We have a restitution fund for that. So
I love that.
That was the first question. What was the second question?
Oh, how can we be praying for you?
How can you be praying? Well, actually the home, we've raised, we had a $200,000 matching grant. We matched it. Now we have a $20,000 matching grant that we're in the process of matching. So for the home, and then we're also in the process of trying to secure a loan for the remainder of the balance that we'll need for the home. So over that process and just over the whole team as a whole, you know, just for our physical and emotional and spiritual health, as we are immersing ourselves in the pain and trauma of other people's lives, that we could stay healthy in the work that we do.
Amen. Amen. And Harmony, take a just a moment and tell us, just mention your book. We'll have it in the link below so people can check it out and get it for themselves, but just to do a self plug for a second.
Yeah. So I wrote my memoir, Scars and Stilettos. It has like the full version of my story. We maybe touched on a few pieces here, but it's really just my journey through a childhood filled with abuse and vulnerability, to being exploited out of strip clubs and then finding freedom from all of that.
Amen. Amen.
So, yeah.
Harmony, thank you for being with us. We will absolutely be praying into those really beautiful things that you're building. And thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I truly love having conversations with you, and I was happy to be invited back. So thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Harmony. Folks, thank you for joining us. If you profited from this episode, please share it with somebody you think would benefit from it. I think these kinds of conversations need to be commonplace. That's why we do what we do. Throw in any comments that you have below. Thank you for tracking with us. And do check out Harmony's book. It's a really accessible self-read. It's not difficult, and it's a story, so it reads well, it reads easy, but it also makes for a good gift. Just pass it along to a family member or a friend, and that'll be in the link below as well. So thank you for joining us. Thank you for being with us, and we will catch you next time on The Naked Gospel.